HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 144, recorded live Tuesday, December 30th, 2008. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott talks with his wife, Intombenhe, an MBA and homemaker from Zimbabwe.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Week 3 in Africa. Actually, week 3 plus 1. We just got back from Africa yesterday. Got off the plane, rolled immediately into bed. Very, very, very jet-lagged. We were going to do a couple more interviews from Africa, but a couple people dropped out at the last minute. So instead, we're talking to my wife. Hi, small wife.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm fine, thank
you. All right, I'm glad. So, small wife, this is my podcast, by the way. You've never done a show with me before.
I haven't, and it's pretty interesting to see it from this side. You know, yeah. All I usually hear is, get out and recording, stay quiet, you know, gag the kids if you have to, for the love of God, keep it down.
But now you have to hold the microphone in your hand yourself.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, keep it close.
How do I sound?
You sound fine, dear. So, what is your name, love?
So, okay, my name is Ndombene Tengiwane, but I go by Mo.
Because I call you Mo.
Because you call me Mo. And people always ask me, they're like, wow, how do you go from Ndombene to Mo? Well, the Mo is part of my middle name, Mola.
Yeah.
And so you grew too lazy to say Mola because those two syllables are such hard work and you cut it down to Mo.
Yeah, and you find it strange and I call you Ndombene.
That's right. That's right. Bizarre. Very weird.
So you're an Ndebele.
I am.
And that is a tribe in Zimbabwe.
That is correct. Yes.
And we've got family spread all over the world. We've got people who have emigrated to Tanzania. We've got people who've emigrated to the U.S., like yourself. You became a citizen a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We've got people who've emigrated to South Africa and worked there. And we had a reunion this last couple of weeks. You are 4 of 7.
Mm-hmm. And when you always say 4 of 7, I don't know if people know that you mean the fourth child of 7, but yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, people who watch Star Trek will recognize what that means. But yes, you are 4 of 7.
Okay.
You're not 7 of 9.
It's like 7 of 9.
Exactly. You're 4 of 7.
Which I always say is like, is that 9 of 11?
It's exactly. 7 of 9. No, you're 4 of 7. So we went and we stayed in the house of 2 of 7,
mm-hmm.
and spent time with the other 6 of 7.
Right.
So you are coming up on your, what I'm calling your halvesies party, which is when you will have been half here and half there, which I think is a particularly interesting thing. You came to the States when?
92.
Yeah. So that's what it was that you were?
18.
18. So you're coming up on the half and half.
Mm-hmm.
And in, sure. You came to Las Vegas when you came here.
New Mexico. Las Vegas, New Mexico. Yeah.
Were you disappointed?
I was. I thought I was being kidnapped. I think I told you this, that, you know, when I heard Las Vegas, I was expecting Nevada. And imagine my surprise when I got tiny, tiny Las Vegas, New Mexico that I had never heard of. And I immediately thought, I'm being kidnapped. Oh, God.
Did you really think you were being kidnapped?
I did. I mean,
like you were bamboozled somehow?
I could not imagine a country having two cities with the same name. It was bizarre, strange.
Yeah. Who would have?
Who does that? You know. So
well, we do. There's like 18. There's 18 Portlands.
I know. I stopped counting after 3. I was like,
yeah,
okay,
exactly. You know, so and this has been an interesting thing in our relationship, I think, because people usually say, "Oh, well, you know, you're white and your wife's black. You must have lots of trouble with color and this and that." And I've always said, "You might as well be purple." The fact is that you're African, and it's the cultural differences that are the trouble. I mean, has color been an issue for us as much as culture?
For us as a couple, less so, I think. But you're right. I mean, people see us and they see the obvious stuff first, obviously.
Right, my beauty, and just the general pulchritude of the Hanselman.
That's right. You know, and,
they
wonder, you know, what you're doing with me and all.
Yeah, I understand.
Are we taping this? Because I've got to recant right away.
Yeah, but they see the obvious stuff.
Stand,
they see the skin color, but they assume, like, for example, I meet people who are who are African American in a mixed relationship, and they'll assume.
Yeah. Yeah, that they don't know that a lot of the stuff that we argue over really is, I mean, cultural stuff, you know, the way you were raised and how wrong that way is, and, you know, how I'm helping you see the light and that kind of thing. So.
Now, you know, one of our very first arguments, cultural arguments, was I think one of the second or third time we were going to see my parents. If you remember correctly, we're on the freeway and I said, we're going to stop by my parents. And you said, well, we need to get something. We need to get some bread because it was dinner time. And I said, no, we don't need to get any bread. And you said, no, we're going to get bread, or I'm going to open the car door and I'm going to roll out onto the freeway and get the bread myself. You were felt very strongly about that. Mm. Why is that so important?
Actually, that wasn't an African thing. That was the American thing. I had observed that a lot of Americans, when they come, first of all, they call before they come. You know, they don't just show up, which, you know, you were just in South Africa, we were staying with my brothers and what have you. And you saw that, I mean, people just stroll in casually and they give very little thought to whether it's convenient or inconvenient for their host. You know, their goal is, we're here to see you, we're happy to be with you. And whether we're coming right at dinner time as you're trying to eat your meal, oh well, you know. So that concern for me was what I'd observed other Americans around me doing. You call first and you bring something. You don't just show up. So it was troublesome to me that we're going to do this to your parents. We're going right at dinner time and just kind of strolling in empty-handed, you know. My impression of that is that it's okay for children, you know, if our boys were to come over and see us, that's fine. They're little. But working adults who are competent and self-sufficient probably should do something. So it bothered me that you were insisting that we not.
Well, I wasn't insisting that we not. It was just like, oh, another place to stop to get more stuff. So Africans don't bring stuff every time they come over? It seems like they do.
No, I mean, really, honestly, we don't. We take stuff when we're going to see somebody at the hospital, obviously, because they're not able to, you know, get out there themselves. But for the most part, I mean, and you saw this, people just showed up.
We had a house of, what, 6 or 7 people, and then we would blink, and suddenly a cousin would come over, or a second cousin, and then they would bring their wife and their 4 kids, and the next thing you know, we've got 15 in a house.
Exactly, and just when, you know, it always seems like it's at an inconvenient time, we're serving dinner for those that we knew were going to be there, and wouldn't you know it, right as people are sitting down to eat, in walks 7 other people, and it's like, oh crap, you know, but somehow food's always found. You make do with whatever little is there, you cut it into quarters, if that doesn't work, into eighths, you know.
That was interesting, because no one ever actually said, I mean, we were there a month, and no one said, you mind if we stay for dinner? Yeah. Or is there enough? You know, I don't want to impose. That was never said. People just sat on the couch, and then a plate appeared.
Right. And sometimes the plate had, you know, a whole bunch of food, and sometimes the plate had very little food, but there was always a plate, and there's always food, you know.
So. Now, when you bring the plate, when people come over, I noticed that people, and of course, I've noticed this for the last 10 years, so I'm speaking a little bit like this is new to me, you know, but for the purposes of the interview, someone would bring a pitcher of water, a towel, and then a big bowl, and you would wash the hands of the guest. And it seemed like that only happened when new people had come over. Like, we didn't do that every day when we were just hanging out, but an uncle would come over, or an auntie, and then that would come out.
Yeah, well, in part, it also depends on, A, you know, where the person's been, right? So if somebody's been working in the car and they don't come in, it's dinner time. Yeah, you're going to offer them that, you know, to wash their hands and what have you. The equivalent, I mean, that happens all the time, wash up before dinner type of thing. But it also depended on what we're eating, right? If we're eating what we call in Zim, sadza, right, the cornmeal, you use your hands to do that. So you would definitely offer everybody their hands, you know, to have them wash their hands so that they're clean. Right, because they're going to eat. But it's also just out of respect, you know, that you'd say, may I wash your hands? And sometimes they'd say, no, you know, my hands are clean, and that's fine. So you'd let it go at that point.
But there was a pecking order, for lack of a better word, because it was always one of the young women in the house that would do the washing.
Right.
It wasn't ever our host, your brother. It wasn't ever me.
Right.
And when you would walk around and bring the water, you did it in, there was kind of an unspoken order.
Right.
Like, let's say that it's me, your mom, and an uncle who's really old. Probably the uncle would go first, and then your mom, and then me. How do you figure those things out? I mean, is that because I was in my mind trying to work out the business rules? You know, I was writing the program to figure out exactly. And I was like, oh, they picked her first. Oh, okay. Is that because she's older? Because she's a woman? You know, how do those things get figured out?
Well, I mean, I would still argue that Africa really is a male-dominated society, you know, and people don't always agree with that, but I think so. And you see this in whether it's, you know, the way you wash people's hands, whether it's the cuts of meat. If you've got a chicken that you cooked, right, who's going to get the bigger piece of chicken? Well, it's not going to be the wife who did the cooking. It's not going to be the kids. It's usually going to be the head of the household.
Really? You guys, you do that?
The male. Yeah.
The big piece of chicken.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know,
that still happens today.
It still does. It still does. I still do that. You know,
yeah, I don't know why you take the big piece of chicken.
16 years of being in this day. As I said, the brains behind the operation.
Stealing chicken from me, dear. What's that about?
Yeah, but you're right, absolutely, that it is going to be an age thing, and then from the age thing, it's going to be respect. So
and gender, though, too.
And gender, yeah.
Right, if
and,
there were two old people, wife and husband, you'd do the man first.
I'd do the man first, I would, yeah.
Does that bother you?
You know, it's what I grew up with, so I never really questioned it too much. That just was the way it was. And as much as the women were the ones that were doing the cooking and the cleaning every night, you saw that, you know, and a couple of times you tried to come in and help, and it made other women feel very uncomfortable to have you there.
That was weird. This happened also 8-9 years ago when we went there the first time, because I think it was like day two in Zimbabwe, the very, very, very first trip. And I was like, all right, dinner's ready. Dinner's done, rather. Let's do the dishes. Because this is what my dad does. You know my dad, right? We did a show with my dad. He would roll up his sleeves and let's start doing the dishes. No, ladies, everybody, ladies, sit down. The men have got this. And he'd make a big, big thing about the men are doing the dishes. And we'd do it. Yeah. You guys kicked me out of the kitchen.
Well, hey, you were in the way bumbling around. So,
well, thank you. Appreciate that.
but you're right. I mean, it was very odd. They didn't know what to do with you. They didn't really know what your role was there. And it was kind of like, what is it that he needs? Let's help him get it so that he can leave.
They kept offering me drinks.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you're obviously looking for something. Right. You're in the kitchen.
Well, you know, they ended up setting, this is the thing, that they ended up sending me outside to make fire. With the other men. So, all we were doing out there was arguing about how best to rearrange the wood such to make this barbecue successful.
While we were toiling away over a hot stove, cooking for 3-4 hours.
Yeah, you guys are mopping the kitchen and we're trying to figure out whether the cardboard goes on top or underneath the wood. It's very high tech.
And yet, I would want to say that, I mean, men work very hard too. You know, if you look at my brother and his wife, I mean, he's doing a lot of work himself, as are you, you know, and so is she. It's
different.
A balance.
It's different.
It's a different balance. Yeah,
right. I mean, she would wake up 4 or 5 in the morning, come out, set up breakfast, and then go back to sleep. And then for us, as the people who woke up at 8, it was a miracle.
Food was.
We went to bed, there was no food. We woke up, there was food. No one was seen. And that was what she did.
Right.
But at the same time, your brother, her husband, would get up at 11 or 12 at night to go and pick up his brother from work and then drop him at his house because he didn't have a car. So it was different work, but it was equal. They're definitely a house where they're working equally hard.
Yeah, everybody's pulling their weight. It's a different kind of weight than what, you know, you and I are doing here in the States.
Yeah, yeah. Did they have any trouble with me coming into the family at all? Or was it, I mean, from a color perspective? Or was it, again, just cultural stuff? Like, this is just a weird guy, as opposed to this is a weird white guy.
Well, I mean, you know, can we say this on your show?
Well, I don't know.
This is all
what are we going to say?
That's right, yeah. We can always edit this, right?
Nah.
The one of the things that happened when I was young was we had an uncle, you know, I don't know if he was a drunkard per se, but he considered himself like a visionary, somebody who could see into the future. And he called it, you know, for me, he just said one day, I must have been 11 or 12, oh, you're going to marry somebody, a foreigner, somebody not from here. You know, we didn't think it was going to be a white guy, but that was always out there for me. So when I left and came to the States, I think that seed had long been planted, even though we dismissed it. What did he know? You know, he wasn't really much of anything. You know, this uncle, I mean, it's not like any other things that he said came true. But nevertheless, he had said it. You know, he explicitly, while we're having dinner one day, just looked
this up. This really happened. I mean, because I've heard this story before, and your sister, the eldest child, your sister actually gave this speech at our wedding.
At our wedding, yeah.
And
yeah.
I was like, this is a story.
No, it actually
really
did happen, yeah. So, were they surprised when I married you? Yeah, they were surprised, but was it a total shock? No, it wasn't. And again, I think the big issue for them wasn't so much your race in as much as it was, I had long been saying I was never going to marry, not just an American, but a foreigner, because I always wanted to go back home to Zimbabwe, because I always wanted to go back and be with my people and help them out. That's why I was getting an education, right? So I could go back home and make a difference. And all of a sudden, here I am saying I'm getting married to you. Mm. And it's like, well, what do you do with that? All that feeling that you've had in the past about, I want to go back home. I want to go back home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I'd always wanted to avoid making somebody choose between me and my people and my home and, mm-hmm. you know, you and your people and your home. So that was, it was a difficult choice. I had expressed it as being a very difficult choice and one that I wasn't willing to make, to have anybody make on my behalf. So mm-hmm. they were surprised. I mean, they were stunned. To
well, and, I, and I remember that you were concerned mm-hmm. even when we were getting married, that you would have to sneak assistance to the family. I mean, you kind of confided in me after the fact, once we found out that it was going to be a non-issue, that you were concerned, well, all right, I'm married, I've made this decision, I married this guy, but I'm still going to have to sneak my own money to the family to help them because he's going to lose patience quickly.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard thing. You know, when you're one of seven, I was raised with a very clear expectation that we take care of ourselves and we take care of each other. And I didn't really think that that was something that a lot of Americans were familiar with. I mean, no disrespect to, you know, to your listeners, but it is such a burden is the wrong word for it, but well, it is maybe an obligation. It is this thing that you're raised with, this idea that take care of yourself and take care of your siblings and your parents.
Maybe
and your
say something about Ubuntu as a concept.
Yeah, I mean, Ubuntu is exactly that, the way of being, I guess. Really, I fail to find the English.
Well, they say people are people through other people.
Yeah.
But you are no one without your other people.
Right, right. I mean, that's a song that you're referencing by Brenda Fassie, a South African singer. But absolutely, umuntu umuntu ngabantu, that's pretty much the same thing. You know, you are who you are because of other people. So in their absence, you are nothing type of thing. And so I didn't think that would be something that my American husband, you know, would understand. I mm-hmm. just didn't think it was a concept that you were going to be familiar with, but it wasn't something that I was willing to give up. So in my mind, it was like, well, mm-hmm. I'm a working individual, you know, I'm bringing in money. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll find a way to get the necessary funds to my family. And of course, thankfully, it was a non-issue because of how you were raised, as it turned out that, you know, you do have similar values, et cetera, et cetera. But I didn't expect that. I mean, before we got married, I really didn't expect that understanding because it is a hard, it's not a short thing, you know, it goes on in perpetuity.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not just a life commitment to you, but it's a life commitment to the other the other seven people, yeah.
And exactly, and their kids.
And their kids and their kids and
exactly.
On.
So it's ongoing and it's work.
And it's not just, I mean, just to be clear, it's not necessarily monetary, but it's to make sure that you're calling everyone and checking in and making sure that everyone's mm-hmm. okay.
Absolutely.
And it's not about writing checks and throwing money over the wall.
That's right. It's emotional support, it's spiritual support, it's you know, if they need you, are you there type of thing.
Do you know how to make the possible out of the impossible? Well, the .NET ninjas at Telerik do. They just released a huge pack of web controls all built on top of ASP.NET Ajax that'll help you build impossibly fast and interactive applications in no time at all. They've made the impossible possible in desktop development. If you think you can't have a carousel component in WinForms, well, you can. Their Windows Forms suite features a super powerful grid view control and 32 other crazy desktop components that'll give you dazzling WPF-like features, but in WinForms. They do the same thing in reporting solutions with a new design surface like nothing else. Looks just like graph paper. Gives you advanced page layout capabilities. Makes it feel more like a graphic design software than a reporting solution. Go check them out at Telerik.com and be a .NET ninja. And thanks for listening.
Now, one of the things that I'm consistently having trouble with when I am, you know, overseas or interacting with your family is this idea of honesty versus diplomacy. And one of the people on our on the blog, one of the commenters on the blog said that this is the difference between me having IQ and you having EQ. Or another way to phrase it is that I'm a socially backward programmer who doesn't know my ass from a hole in the ground. And you are, a subtle and thoughtful member of society. Has that idea of being straight with people versus being diplomatic while still getting the message across been an issue for us?
Yeah, I think it has been an issue for us. I thought you were going to ask if it's been an issue just for me in general. It has been. I mean, I remember when I first came to the States, I found people very, very abrupt. Mm-hmm. You know, people would just say, hey, can you do XYZ for me? And I think, good grief, you just don't care about me at all, do you? There's no, hello, how are you doing? You know, how's the day treating you? None of that. There was just
no
always
pleasantries.
Good. Exactly. No play. And I found it very abrupt, you know, so I did have a bit of trouble with that. And I think you and I have gone back and forth on this issue of, you know, you want something, but care a little bit about me, the person you're talking to, enough to value my well-being before you value whatever it is that you want from me, you know. So it's been difficult. But what I found very interesting is, as we've been married and over the years as I've gone back, people say that I am just as abrupt now as they would find you, which I'm shocked. I'm stunned. How is that possible?
You know, and that gets back to the idea that you're half here and half there.
Yeah.
And you don't – I always feel like when we go there and we try to go to Africa every year or two, that you reassert your Africanness, you know, with all due respect here.
Uh-huh.
Your accent swishes back. You start to hit words differently. You start to kind of move the needle in the other direction a little bit and be extra African.
Interesting.
Do you consciously, do you have any conscious understanding of maybe doing that, of reasserting or, you know, stamping your foot in the ground and just kind of pushing a little harder to make sure that you remember where you came from?
You know, I don't. You're not the only person, though, who's pointed that out. I remember that a couple of our cousins just a couple of weeks ago were saying the same thing. It's not a conscious thing that I do. Obviously, I do it because even they heard it. They said, whoa, you know.
So I'm not the only one, because you've told me for years that I was insane and this was just me.
And I actually remember, you know.
This is news.
Being an engineer, you actually recorded it at one point in time. And when you played it back to me, hear it. But in the moment, no.
Right. Well, that's the accent. You know. I mean, the accent thing is easily proven. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're talking in your language, which is really kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like Spanglish in the sense of it's half Andalusian and half English, because you use a lot of borrowed words. Your language uses a lot of borrowed words.
Mm-hmm.
Those borrowed words are said explicitly in the Andalusian accent.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm thinking more of the personality stuff. You know, you're even more deferential to elders when you're there. I mean, you really are when in Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Do as the Romans do.
But to be clear, I mean, I think it's the amplification of who I am is what you're getting at there, because I do believe in being deferential to elders even here when I'm away from that,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it probably is just a desire to just blend in and not be, you know. What's been interesting about our lives from a race point of view is that when we're in the States, I'm typically the one that stands out because Oregon has so few Black people, for mm-hmm. instance. But when we get to whether it's Zimbabwe or South Africa, you know, like we're just in Joburg, mm-hmm. you know, went to the mall and you were one
the
of
mall.
What
we didn't just go to the mall. We went to the Soweto Mall, Moponia Mall.
Exactly.
Which is not just the Black Mall, but it's like the Black Mall in Soweto.
Yeah.
And yeah, there was me and one other guy.
And he didn't show up.
Well, he worked there.
He didn't, we didn't even see him for a while.
Yeah.
So it was very interesting to me to have you be the one now that's sort of anything that you do, you've got, you know, 15, 20, 30 pairs of eyes that are pretending not to be watching you, but they're watching you. You know, you've got a lot of people that are listening to you, but pretending to be, you know, nonchalantly doing something else or whatever. And so that I think is where race comes in. But coming back to the issue of honesty versus diplomacy, I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think you tend to hit it hard. You're very, very honest, you as an individual. And I think maybe a lot of Americans as a people are honest too. And I'm generalizing here. So
yeah,
with me.
Understood.
You know, whereas, you know, I was raised with this idea that even if I have to listen to my grandmother say something that I know is absolutely wrong,
mm-hmm.
What does it hurt me to let her think she's right?
Right.
You know, at the end of the day, when all is said and done, you know, I can, in my head, know that I was right, but give her this one small thing.
Right.
And so I learned to just let a lot of stuff go, good, bad, or indifferent. It's, you know, certainly I wouldn't stand there and let her, you know, perjure herself or something extreme.
Sure, but
for
you
the
give
most
people
part,
a lot
you know,
of, you give
attitude.
Them a lot of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is, I think, one of the problems with not just Americans, again, we continue to generalize, but people are time obsessed, and I am certainly time obsessed. So every time we go to Africa and we get more than 5 or 10 people in the room, there's some kind of a crisis. Might be a little crisis. We had a crisis where we wanted to buy a refrigerator.
Right.
And when I say crisis, I mean tiny lowercase c. It was a very simple.
Right.
Let's buy a fridge. You know. We got some young, our brothers are starting their life. They need a fridge. From my point of view, I wanted to attack it like, all right, what are the candidate fridges? Right. What are our candidate fridges? I was ready to do the whole Consumer Reports write-up on the fridge. Mm. Well, I felt that you guys were just going on and on and on and on and on about unrelated, unfridge-related things, unrefrigerator-related things. And it made me realize that there's this thing that you've always told me, cry with the crying.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to say something about what that means, cry with the crying?
Well, I mean, it's just basically empathize, really, is the long and the short of it. You know, I think talking about you personally, you tend to come in and be very efficient, right? And you want to get the job done. If you come in and you find people, you know, sort of lamenting that, oh, we're hungry. You know,
the fridge. What are we going to do? Where do we go?
Exactly. You know, whether it's hunger, whether it's the fridge, whether it's a car, whatever, you know, you just sort of want to identify the problem, you know, and attack it and just handle it.
Right,
get it done.
Right. I have found in Africa that saying, all right, everyone, what is the very next action? Not the best way to attack a problem in South Africa, at least in my experience.
No, and speaking for specifically just for my family.
Well, let's go specifically to Endebele culture, Black South Africa, your family.
Yeah, yeah.
This very likely, I'm sure that there are families that maybe attack things this way. Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe not, but definitely not my finest hour.
Right, right. I mean, when you do that, then you're coming in, you've taken away the people, you know, that were mid-discussion, you're finding us in the middle of a conversation, and you just stop everything and just kind of like, oh, I am here, I have seen the light, and let me show you, you know. And you don't mean it that way, but it just has this very, it's cold water, you know. Mm-hmm. It just stops the discussion and leaves everybody feeling very confused. And what ends up happening then is that people defer to you, mm-hmm. you know. And so at the end of it all, you know, when you then
defer to me because I'm the loud one?
You're the loud one, and you're the one that's come in and sort of asserted yourself aggressively and said, mm-hmm. let's get this job done my way. And then afterwards, when you ask them and say, so are you happy with the fridge? Then the pushback is, well, you are. And then you're taken aback. You're stunned. It's like, what do you mean I am? Well, sure. We did it your way. So as long as you are happy with the fridge, what do you need from me? You know?
Mm-hmm. So let's take that concept and then let's flip it on its ear. After you graduated with your MBA, you went to work. And you went to work with a very diverse crowd of different ages and different colors and different levels of experience. And when it came to sitting in a room and solving a problem, not necessarily getting a fridge, but procuring something else or working through an issue at one of the nonprofits that you worked at, how did your technique and your style and your Africanness work within the context of a room full of Americans?
It was difficult. I mean, there was definitely a learning curve for me, right? When I'm in the office or if I'm taking a call from a client, for instance, they may or may not be interested in my 5-minute, 10-minute warm up before I get to the real problem. There were people that legitimately didn't have a lot of time. They needed things handled and handled quickly. So it took a while, but I guess I've always seen a difference between a professional setting and a social setting. You know, I've always made that distinction.
Really, whether it be in Africa or in America.
Right, right. I mean, even in Zim, you know, people get things done, even in Zim. So I don't want to imply that, you know, Zimbabwe is a bunch of incompetent people that just, you know, everybody's sitting around just kind of saying, yeah, you know, don't worry about the time.
Well,
or
yeah. Well, like when I blogged about African time, mm-hmm. A very large number of people who've been to Africa immediately related. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people felt a little offended, a little insulted that I was saying, oh, well, you're saying Africans are lazy and late? And no, what I was trying to say, and apparently I failed, was that Africans have a much more fluid perception of time, but that doesn't necessarily mean that a business meeting is going to be running 3-4 hours late.
That's right. That's right. It all depends on what the situation is. You know, mm-hmm. I talked about going to visit people in the hospital, for instance. We may leave the house and say, okay, we're going to visit, you know, Uncle Mike or whoever for 20 minutes. When we get there, if we find that, you know, he really is in a bad state, for instance, I'll be more inclined to spend a couple of hours with him, mm-hmm. you know, or if we're just having a good time or whatever the case may be. Whereas I would suggest that you probably would still sort of say, hey, we came in here saying we're going to give it 20 minutes or 20 minutes are up. Let's go. Let's do this. You know, so. Mm-hmm. It's probably a little unfair.
I hear what you're saying. Examples like that are always unfair, but the point is that if someone in Zimbabwe were trying to close on their mortgage, they're going to show up on time at the mortgage broker for the thing.
Right.
But if there's a dinner afterwards for 5 o'clock, they may roll in at 8:30.
That's right. Depending on who's hosting the dinner, if it's, you know, again,
if it's an
your
elder,
boss,
what the expectations are.
Yeah. First of all, I mean, just you don't disrespect, really. That's the way I was raised. So if my mom were waiting for me somewhere, I would be less inclined to keep her waiting, for instance, than I would a friend of mine, because then I'd say, oh, you know, I was doing this, that, and the other thing. And, you know,
and this goes both ways. People are equally forgiving based on context.
Right. And you saw with my brothers, for instance, you know, they'd leave, or I'd go with them, or you'd go with them, and they'd say, I'll be back in an hour. And then four hours later, they stroll back in, no apology.
Well, you know, I have a lot of trouble with that, because I always maybe over-empathize about the other person's time. We went to pick up one of our cousins, and he was in downtown Joburg, and we were supposed to pick him up at 11. I think he got picked up around 3. And I thought he was being artificially gracious, because he was saying, no, it was fine. You know, we just hung around. But this was on, he was totally fine. He took the opportunity of our lateness to show his wife around downtown. And they spent a very leisurely and relaxed 4 hours, which I can't even conceive of, a leisurely and relaxed 4 hours of waiting for a ride, to see the sights.
Right.
So it's not just about lateness or waiting for someone to be late, but it's also taking advantage of the time to do other things, which is consistently difficult for me to get my brain around.
Well, and I think it's all about, you know, how you take it, right? If you understand that they mean no disrespect to me by not being here, then you're more likely to roll with it and let it go. If you assume that, oh, Mo said she was going to be here at 11, it's 11:10, she's still not here, that means she thinks my 10 minutes are not worth much of anything.
Right, that's a it's very representative of what she thinks of
that's
me
right,
as a person.
That's right. But if you say to me, well, Scott said he was going to pick me up at 11, it's now noon, I know that in that hour, whatever he was doing was really very compelling, so much so that he thought it best that he take care of that issue than come here and get me. Then when you come, I can say, so what was going on? And you'll probably tell me, you know, I had a flat tire, or to take care of the babies, or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's usually something, you know, in that instance that our cousin was waiting for us, you know, my brother was supposed to pick them up, I think was somewhere helping somebody else take care of a really big...
He had a legitimate reason.
A legitimate thing. It's never, the assumption is never that you're dissing me and you're disrespecting me and you think, you know, I'm not worth anything to you. So I think it's all about perspective, really.
Yeah, well, the culture gap is consistently a challenge for us. I mean, time is one thing. Interacting with my parents versus your parents, I know that there's a rule that I'm not supposed to, if I understand correctly, be in the same room as your mom alone, or I'm not supposed to eat.
Yeah.
What is the rule?
It's not that you're not supposed to be in the same room with her, and this is really old school. My parents were not like that, even before my dad passed away.
They grew up in the city, right?
Yeah, and so they've let go of a lot of stuff, and they're fairly educated, so they don't hold on to a lot of the traditions as much as some people might. But right, the idea is that eating is indelicate, so that is something that should be done separate from the son-in-law / the mother-in-law. So if my mom is eating, you should show your respect to her by letting her eat freely, by not being in that room, that type of thing.
So
you let her eat freely, you know, in as much as if she were to take a bath, for instance, you wouldn't be in the same room, obviously, and on and on. So
So, I mean, it's obvious to me in my culture that I would not be in the bathroom while your mom's taking a bath.
Right.
Same kind of an idea. While she is eating and smacking her lips and doing all that eating stuff.
Right.
And I remember early on, we had there was a little debate, mini, tiny debate about, are we going to follow these rules? What exactly are we going to do?
Mm-hmm. And they immediately, my parents immediately just blew them off and said, he can't possibly know about these things. So, you know, a lot of it was just sort of waived. I mean, even the bride gift, I think you kind of had to push to do it, because they just said, he's not one of us.
Well, the bride gift was an interesting thing, because I knew that the impression that I got from your mom and dad was that it would have been appreciated. It was appreciated when we did go through with it. Mm-hmm. But I could tell that they were hedging it, in the sense that they were saying, well, you know, if this white American doesn't want to go through our process, let's let him off the hook.
Right.
But I had a sense that if we didn't go through with it, it would be one of those little back of the mind things 10, 20 years later that would be remembered, not necessarily with negativity, but not with fondness. They're not going to go, oh, we're fond of the fact that he didn't go through the process.
Right.
So there were, I mean, maybe speak a little bit about the bride gift, because I remember we had to get a blanket for your mom to keep her warm. This is called lobola.
So, yeah, I mean, lobola basically is the, it's, your way of thanking my family for taking such good care of me and raising me, and all that good stuff. And it is in its purest form. It really is just a way of expressing appreciation. Obviously, with the hard economic times, it's become corrupt. A lot of people use it as a way to get money and get rich kind of quicker than they would otherwise. That is not what the original intent was. It really was just a way of saying, I acknowledge that, you know, you've raised this wonderful woman and I thank you for it.
And to be clear, this is not a dowry in the sense of the husband to be receives money from the bride's parents, but rather this is a bride gift in that the young man who is marrying the woman is presenting gifts, cows, and blankets to the parents of the prospective bride to be. So it's a little bit reversed from what you would think of as a traditional dowry. It's not a dowry.
Right. And I guess it depends on your perspective.
And it's not a bride price
either. I grew up with it being the man does the giving. So for me, you never have to explain to me that it's not a dowry. You know what I mean?
This is for the listeners.
Right. But, yeah. And you're right. It used to be called, and it still is called, I guess, the bride price, really. But I don't like that term because it sort of says you're buying something, as I said, in its purest form. It really is a way of expressing appreciation and gratitude to your future wife's family for taking care of her, you know?
Now, is it also set up as a place for the bride to fall back on if the relationship doesn't work out? She can go back to her parents and they're not destitute?
You know, I don't know. I have to
I've heard that theory.
I don't know. I wouldn't have said so, but it's entirely possible. I always thought that it was just, as I said, that expression of appreciation. But it tends to be difficult, you know. I mean, I can't – my parents, obviously, because you weren't a Zimbabwean and we had no way of getting cows for you,
We just went with cash because I couldn't find cows. But we did get the blanket, the ijali.
That's right.
And, for your mom.
And we did have a goat.
And we did have a goat and went through that whole process.
Right.
But I gave the monetary equivalent of a number of cows, while your brother – who is marrying a woman from Swaziland is going through a much more formal process with actual cow procurement.
Right.
Which is quite a challenge because, you know, he's a city guy.
Mm-hmm,
right.
He is, yeah.
You know, he's a businessman and he's got to go and find, uncles and people who are going to represent him and help him to find these cows.
Right.
It's an ongoing process.
And it is a process. I mean, it really is a journey because, you know, you could go a couple, two, three times and be sent back, you know, just to, as a way of testing your determination and how, you know, your endurance. How committed is this guy to our daughter, you know? And so the first time you show up, they may say, we don't want to talk to you. Go away. And they may chase you out of the house, you know? And then you come back again and then they chase you out of the house again. And then maybe the third time they'll listen to you and welcome you in and that type of thing. So it is not, the process is long, and it is, but again, everybody does it as a sign of respect. So,
well, it's definitely been a challenge with one foot in Africa and one foot in America, but thank you, Small Wife, for talking to me today on this special edition of Hansel Minutes, and we will see you again next week.
That's right. Take care.